The U.S. Department of Agriculture estimates that approximately 50 million people in the U.S. obtain their drinking water from groundwater that is potentially contaminated with pesticides and other agricultural chemicals. And 90% of Americans show pesticide residues in their blood and urine.
Welcome to Cambridge Forum in Harvard Square to discuss an important topic, whitewash, the story of a weed killer, cancer, and the corruption of science. I'm Mary Stack, the director of Cambridge Forum, and tonight we have with us Kerry Gillam, investigative journalist and author of Whitewash, for which she has received the Rachel Carson Book Award. Gillam has been investigating powerful pesticide companies like Monsanto for many years, unearthing the facts, uncovering the lies, in an effort to protect the public and expose the interests of corporate profit. Tonight's guest, Kerry Gillam, lives in the farm state of Kansas with her three children. She spent 17 years with Reuters International News Agency before becoming director of the nonprofit US Right to Know. This is an organization which aims to pursue truth and transparency in America's food system. Let's give a warm welcome to Kerry Gillam.
Thank you. Thank you very much. So, yeah, I am a journalist. I've been a journalist for 30 years, covering corporate America, covering food and agriculture. I was assigned to that beat in 1998 by the global newswire Reuters. At that time, agriculture was going through a pretty profound change. Monsanto had just introduced genetically engineered crops. These Roundup Ready crops were designed to encourage and be used in conjunction with, of course, Monsanto's Roundup herbicide. And it was, you know, changing the way that farmers produced our food and changing a lot of traditional agricultural practices. So it was my job to learn everything I could about that, spend time with farmers in their fields and food companies, time with scientists and grain handlers, and time with Monsanto in its headquarters, which I did many, many times, meeting with their scientists and corporate executives and marketing professionals. And it was also my job to learn about their rivals and the competition in the marketplace. Of course, as I did my research and became more familiar with this industry, I came to follow the science as it emerged about the impacts of this chemical, glyphosate, which was used in Roundup. And the research has evolved very distinctly over 20 years, and a lot of that is what I lay out in the book. But the reason that I actually wrote the book was not so much about Monsanto and Roundup, but really because over these 20 years of research and covering food and farming, I came to sort of the knowledge, the realization, what the data shows us is that we have created a really profound problem for ourselves with a pesticide-dependent food system here in the United States. Health professionals around the world have been warning us and publishing scientific papers and different documents and opinion pieces trying to alert us, regulators, consumers, others, to the dangers that this pesticide-dependent food system poses, both for environmental health and for human health. But what we're seeing is a handful of really powerful corporations, Monsanto, Bayer, DuPont, Dow, Syngenta, pushing the messaging that we should not worry about that the rewards of these pesticides and the specialty seeds far outweigh the risks, and that we should not listen to the health experts who are trying to warn us about future dangers, but we should trust them even as they reap the billions of dollars in revenues every year off the sale of these. So glyphosate and Monsanto, I say, is really the poster child, I think. It's the narrative thread through my book. Other people say tip of the iceberg, but it's not just one pesticide, it's not just one company that we need to be aware of and educated about. We need to really fully understand this so that we can make the changes and be informed and engaged in public policy that protects public health and not corporate profits. As I said, bulk of my research, the narrative thread in this book is about glyphosate. You probably already know about it, but 1974 is when Monsanto introduced glyphosate to the world, a novel herbicide, worked very efficiently, very effectively, killing a broad range of weeds. It's used not only by farmers in their fields, but golf course operators use it. It's used by, governments and forestry management, utility right-of-ways. It's used by school districts and city councils and parks and playgrounds where children play. And, of course, many homeowners use it on their lawns and in their gardens. The most widely used herbicide in history. We've gone from 40 million pounds approximately in the 1990s to about 300 million pounds used now in the United States. 123 million pounds worldwide in the 90s to about 1.8 billion pounds used now. It's found pervasively in food, water, air, soil, found in our own bodies. USGS, part of the Department of Interior, has documented it in rainfall. It is ubiquitous and pervasive in our lives. But again, this is about more than glyphosate. Pesticides generally, I call this some not-so-fun facts, I suppose. About 1 billion pounds of pesticides are used in the United States each year. Approximately 5.6 billion pounds of pesticides are used worldwide annually. The U.S. Department of Agriculture estimates that approximately 50 million people in the U.S. obtain their drinking water from groundwater that is potentially contaminated with pesticides and other agricultural chemicals. And 90% of Americans show pesticide residues in their blood and urine, according to biomonitoring by our CDC. One of the ties that we hear a lot about when we talk about pesticides is cancer, one of the outcomes. And that certainly is one of the concerns. It's something that's very near to me. I don't know about the rest of you in the audience. Usually I ask people for a show of hands if you know someone close to you who has had cancer or died of cancer. Usually almost every hand goes up. Myself, relatives, friends, neighbors. My son's 16-year-old friend, a football player, diagnosed last year with cancer. The statistics now are 1 in every 2 men will get cancer in their lifetime, 1 in every 3 women here in the United States. Our National Toxicology Program has been warning us. They put out a report in 2016 and said we need to not only focus on how to treat it, how to pop a pill or cut off a body part or radiate ourselves, we need to focus on how to prevent it. And understanding environmental contaminants, pesticides is a big part of that. We are poisoning ourselves. So back to the poster child, glyphosate. As you probably know, in 2015, there was big news out of the World Health Organization. This is the International Agency for Research on Cancer, a group of scientists from around the world who come together regularly to examine the scientific literature on different substances that are thought to have the potential to be carcinogenic. They looked at glyphosate, they looked at epidemiology and toxicology. Again, they did not do new research, they looked at research that had been done and published. And they classified glyphosate as a probable human carcinogen based on a range of these studies. What happened next, of course, was this explosion of litigation. About 8,500 people estimated are now suing Monsanto, claiming that Roundup or other glyphosate-based herbicides, not glyphosate by itself, but the actual formulated products, which include other ingredients, have caused them to develop non-Hodgkin lymphoma, and that Monsanto has long known about the dangers and has suppressed the information and failed to warn them. And the first trial concluded with a jury verdict on August 10th of $289 million, $250 million of that, which was in punitive damages. You may have seen in the news the judge reduced the punitive damages to $39 million. But she let the verdict stand. And the jurors, it was a unanimous verdict. The jurors looked at scientific evidence that was presented to them by both sides, of course. Monsanto had a team of attorneys to present the science that they say indicates that glyphosate and Roundup products are not carcinogenic, and the plaintiffs presented the science that they said indicates that it is. But additionally, what has come out of the litigation, which has been so fascinating for a reporter, are the internal Monsanto documents that many people have come to refer to as the Monsanto Papers. And these are millions of pages of records that Monsanto has turned over in discovery, internal emails and reports and strategy, communications. And what has been revealed is not just science, but how Monsanto works to manipulate the science, to hide the science, to suppress the science, to harass outside scientists who try to warn about risks that they see in the studies, to harass journalists. There have been a lot of documents like that that really lay out deceptive tactics. I call it decades of deception. And it begs the question to a certain extent, if this product really is so very safe, why would you need to go to such lengths to try to hide it, to try to deceive consumers and lawmakers, manipulate regulators? And I wrote an article for The Guardian that said, really, Monsanto was undone by its own words. The science is compelling, but the evidence of the lack of concern for consumers, the lack of concern for human health, the concern for how do we manipulate, how do we ghostwrite, that those are their own words, ghostwrite, we want to ghostwrite this scientific report. When you see that laid out, it resonates, and it resonated with the jury. I think we're going to see more of that, of course. We have 10 more trials that are currently set for 2019. There are going to be many more coming about. Monsanto has vowed to appeal. So this is something that's going to go on for many years, and we don't know yet how the litigation is going to play out, but it certainly has raised awareness around the world. People are really concerned about this. So one example of the ghostwriting, which is out there right now, which I think is particularly compelling and people should be aware of, Monsanto really wanted to discredit the International Agency for Research on Cancer. They actually talked about it before this IARC group met, before the IARC group even classified glyphosate as a probable human carcinogen. You can see in their internal documents, they talk about that they expect it will be classified as a probable or a possible human carcinogen, and they lay out a plan about how they're going to go after these scientists and try to discredit them. One of the ways that they decided they wanted to do this was they wanted to publish a series of papers that would discredit IARC, that would contradict IARC and say how wrong it was. But of course, they didn't want these papers to look like they came from Monsanto. They wanted them to look like they were independent. And in fact, these papers were published in the Critical Reviews in Toxicology in 2016, and these papers were called an independent review. And they came out and found IARC to be completely wrong. In the acknowledgments for these papers, they state no one from Monsanto had anything to do with these manuscripts before they were published in terms of reviewing them. But what you see in the internal Monsanto emails is not only did they review them, not only did they directly pay some of the authors secretly in arrangements that were not disclosed, but they actually had a very heavy hand in drafting and editing and writing parts of these papers. So it's a very aggressive strategy to try to control the narrative. What all of this has done and why it is so meaningful is because with the suppression of science, with the manipulation of the scientific record, there are many examples of ghostwriting that we don't have time to get into tonight. With all of the marketing of the pesticides and telling consumers and farmers and others that they don't need to worry about these scientific studies, these junk science studies, what we've seen, of course, is an explosion of pesticide residues in our foods. Interestingly enough, our FDA, there's a chemist at the FDA who found glyphosate residues in a range of oatmeal products in 2016. I write about him in my book. He pulled baby food from store shelves, oatmeal products that we feed to our young children, and he found glyphosate at very worrisome levels and notified his supervisors at the FDA about that. You won't find that published in any FDA report. He also sampled honey from around the United States, even organic honey, and found glyphosate levels, again, at very high levels, at what would be considered illegally high levels, except no level in the United States is really considered legal at this point. And again, supervisors kind of told him to just go away and be quiet, and you will not find that information in any published report by the FDA. I'm getting a bit off track, I suppose, but this has been a particular sticking point with me, and I do write about it quite a bit in my book, because the FDA and the USDA are responsible for testing foods every year, specifically for pesticide residues. They've been doing this for decades. Consumers may not be aware of residues in the foods, but our regulatory agencies certainly are. For all of these years, they have skipped testing for glyphosate, even though it's the most widely used herbicide in agriculture. It was only in 2016, after the Government Accountability Office criticized the USDA and the FDA for failing to test for glyphosate, that the FDA said, okay, you know, we'll start to do some limited testing. And they finally just did release a very small amount of information about the glyphosate testing. They did not include information about the oatmeal. They did not include information about honey. They did not include a memo that I have a copy of from inside the FDA. Another FDA chemist who is talking to his supervisor saying he's finding glyphosate in granola and wheat crackers, and he says he's bringing food from home and he's finding glyphosate in everything. The only thing he can't find it in is broccoli, according to this memo. So, you know, this, again, is the poster child for this problem that we have with pesticide residues in foods. And you hear a lot about glyphosate, I think, in food because it is Monsanto, but there are so many other pesticides. Our newest information from the FDA says about 50% of our vegetables, close to 80% of fruits, are carrying pesticide residues. Overall, about 50% of the foods being consumed by Americans, as sampled by the FDA, contain pesticide residues. And again, these are residues of chemicals, pesticides, that are tied to cancers and diseases and neurodevelopmental problems and immune system problems. One of them is called chlorpyrifos, a real nerdy name here, but that's an insecticide marketed by Dow Chemical. It's known to cause neurodevelopmental damage to children. The science is so foundational behind that it's been banned from household use. The EPA has said it is no longer considered safe at any level in food or water. It was supposed to be banned from agriculture last year. But Dow Chemical and CropLife America lobbied the new Trump administration so heavily and convinced them to drop the ban. And so chlorpyrifos is still in our food. This is one of the chemicals that scientists are so worried about because it is so dangerous and so damaging to children, and the primary exposure is through diet. It's one of the top 10 most prevalent pesticides found in our foods today, according to the FDA. And again, you know, this is a very good example of how we're letting corporate interests and corporate profits take precedent over concerns about public health. So what I'm hoping to do, I guess, with the book and with all of the presentations that I make like this tonight is sort of bring us back to a time when we were engaged and aware and we were trying to make a difference in public policy and be protective of public health, and go way back to Rachel Carson, right, and Silent Spring. And her book, you know, warned us, and she used DDT sort of as the narrative. DDT, by the way, is still found in our food, according to the most recent FDA report. But she warned us about the indiscriminate use of pesticides and warned us that if we did not understand fully the risks that came with the rewards, that we were creating large and profound and lasting problems for our environment and for our children's future. And the point that I'm trying to make in Whitewash is that while we listened and we seemed to pay attention to that, we created the Environmental Protection Agency, a lot of environmental defense organizations came into being, we seem to have forgotten that lesson. And the balance has swung too far the other way. And we need to get back in balance. Yes, there are rewards with pesticides, but there are also very real risks. And unless we do something about those, we cannot stay on this pesticide-dependent treadmill. We're already seeing soil degradation. We're seeing weed resistance. We're seeing insect resistance. We're seeing farmers throughout the Midwest who were using glyphosate and have no concerns about it, but now it just doesn't work that well, and so they're piling on dicamba and 2,4-D and other herbicides. It's not a system that is sustainable. So if I have time to read this quote from Rachel Carson, yes. If having endured much, we have at last asserted our right to know, And if by knowing we have concluded that we are being asked to take senseless and frightening risks, then we should no longer accept the counsel of those who tell us that we must fill our world with poisonous chemicals. We should look about and see what other course is open to us. That's the message of whitewash. It's not a feel-good story, but it's a story that has to be told.
You are listening to Cambridge Forum in Harvard Square as we continue our discussion of whitewash, the story of a weed killer, cancer, and the corruption of science. I can't for the life of me understand how we went from a pretty decent farming system with rotation and land being laid fallow to this mythological Disney world where I remember Monsanto's initial pitch was that they were going to feed the world.
Right.
And I'm still puzzled over how they pitched this and how farmers even went for it.
Well, I mean, it's a pretty complex system, but the farmers, at least here in the United States, and the ones that I got to know and talk to, row crop farmers primarily are the ones we're talking about here, because the GMOs, Roundup Ready crops, are primarily soy and corn, alfalfa, cotton, canola, sugar beet are the main ones. There is not a Roundup Ready wheat, although Monsanto tried very hard to get a Roundup Ready wheat and does, in fact, encourage farmers to spray Roundup over their wheat shortly before they harvest it. But to get to your point, farmers loved it. It was great for farmers because before this system, it is a lot of work to manage your fields and to rotate crops and to use cover crops and to use differential row spacing and to do all of these things that encourage biodiversity and soil health. Like, that's a lot of work. And the farmers who were using this Roundup Ready system, they could go get another job. I mean, it made it so much easier for them, and it worked great. Roundup worked great initially until weeds started developing resistance and until soil health started year after year after year of glyphosate, year after year after year of no crop rotation, no diversity other than maybe corn, soy, really left the soil, you know, in sad shape, which made the crops more vulnerable to disease. So, it worked great at first, but after a long time, it didn't work so great. Mother Nature adapted to a certain extent with resistance, so it doesn't work so great anymore. I mean, as I said, the farmers in my book, there are a lot of them still using it, but they're having to do other things. I was out in the field with a farmer in Kansas the other day who still uses it, still plants Roundup Ready corn, but he's also tilling his field now, which, of course, one of the main reasons that you would buy Roundup Ready is because so you wouldn't have to till your fields. But he has to till his fields to control the weeds. So it's just not working.
Thank you very much. I'm wondering if you can comment about subsidies, the farm policy, USDA. Are we actually subsidizing and encouraging through the farm policy the use of all this stuff? And is there a way that you think we could maybe reform some of that would help?
Right. I mean, we subsidize very heavily this system now, you know, with corn subsidies and soy and these row crops. We have roughly a billion bushels of corn every year that we can't sell, we can't eat, we can't use for fuel, and so it goes into a big storage elevator. So it's not that we aren't growing enough. It's that we, you know, are subsidizing too much, essentially, and we are not subsidizing to nearly the degree needed foods grown without these pesticides and organic foods. And there is a group of farmers right now that I'm talking to in the U.S. Midwest who have a little tiny bit of money from USDA, and they are developing these strategies to grow crops without dependence on pesticides, and they're recording their data because USDA, even, you know, USDA, our own government, sees this as not sustainable, and that we do need to change our subsidies and our policies overall, but, you know, it's baby steps. It's people are becoming aware. But it's still a long way to go, I guess.
And I guess I'll follow on with a different question, which is about just the farmers themselves and their families and their own health and what they just see in their communities. And is there a growing awareness of the problems that this whole system
is creating? I think there
is.
I mean, particularly in Iowa, if you look at what's happening to the drinking water in Iowa because of the runoff of nitrates from farm fields and other agrochemicals, it's almost like the lead in Flint. You know, I mean, it's a real or the contamination in Flint. It's a real health crisis developing in Iowa. But yeah, I mean, I would say people are becoming aware. You're seeing a movement all around the country in localities where people are, you know, going to their school boards and their city councils and saying, we don't want these pesticides sprayed in our parks where our kids play. We'll have dandelions grow. We don't care. Our kids roll around in the grass. You know, it is notable, though, that in the Farm Bill, there is a provision in there that would preempt all of these local provisions and basically make it impossible for local governments and local communities to restrict pesticide use.
You might know me.
Yeah.
My name is Mary Mangan, and I published a book review on your book called Hogwash.
Yeah, I know.
It's on BioFortified, for those of you who haven't read it yet. Why did you ignore all the science that was available? Because I laughed, actually, when you started talking today. You said you came to follow the science. How exactly did you ignore the breast milk studies, for example? And how come you didn't mention this large two-year National Academy of Sciences major study on GMOs in your book at all? Like, that's like ignoring the IPCC in a climate book. I mean, this is just ridiculous. Why would you ignore all that science?
The National Academy of Sciences study on GMOs, book isn't about GMOs. Books about glyphosate.
Can we have the next person?
Sorry, you cut off my mic?
Please.
Is that what happened?
Did you come up to the mic?
My mic has been cut off?
No, we're running out of time.
I'm sorry. For those of you who are interested, so Mary wrote this review and published it at a site called BioFortified. And in the Monsanto internal documents, they list BioFortified as a partner that they wanted to use to help discredit the International Agency for Research on
Cancer. Excuse me.
Carrie has nothing but conspiracy theories. She's ignoring the science.
Would you mind letting somebody else come up to the microphone?
She's
just presenting conspiracy theories constantly.
Yeah,
thank you.
I mean, this is a great example of what happens to people, journalists, scientists, others, anybody who sort of publishes information that threatens the industry agenda. There are people like Mary who attack, try to discredit, harass, show up at public speeches. It doesn't just happen to me. It happens to lots of people.
Okay, next question, please.
Hi, I am a small organic farmer here in Massachusetts, and I was wondering if you guys had any way of activating the consumer to care more about where their food comes from, and how do you hope to change the food system without kind of getting more people to not just go for the cheap thing or not just go for the easy grocery store run, but to actually become involved in their food system a little bit more directly.
Here's what I would say. If you want to make people aware, get the FDA or the USDA annual pesticide residue program data, which is a book like this, and just hand it to you. When you look at all of the different pesticides that are used in conventionally grown foods, and the insecticides and the... It's frightening. And when you see that 20 different pesticide residues of 20 different pesticides are, can commonly be found in a bowl of strawberries or blueberries, for instance, when you know that, when you have that data and that information, I think it's impactful to people. You know, and some people aren't going to care. I mean, some people still smoke cigarettes. Some people, drink wine. I mean, it's about information. It's about making choices, I think, that are important in your own life or that, fit into the context of your own decision-making. And you saw, I'm sure, the study that came out that indicated that consumption of organic foods indicates a possible lowering of cancer risk, right? Did you see that? But information is power, and it's out there. There's data out there.
I'd like to thank Carrie Gillam for this wonderful presentation.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Whitewash, the story of a weed killer, cancer, and the corruption of science, a Cambridge Forum event being recorded live in Harvard Square. Cambridge Forum is sponsored by the Lowell Institute, the Massachusetts Cultural Council, Harvard Bookstore, and Friends of the Cambridge Forum. Thanks very much for coming, and please come again.